it's time for the Des Moines Register on Monday, March 25. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Nicole Tam. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuWeather, we should look for a severe thunderstorm Monday, a shower in the morning, then showers and a heavier thunderstorm to the east. Winds south 20 to 30 miles per hour. And the forecast for the next few days in central Iowa looks like this. A severe thunderstorm on during the afternoon. Storms can bring damaging winds, flooding, and a tornado. So let's be careful here in central Iowa. Looking out for that. Winds 20 to 30 miles per hour out of the south. And a shower again Monday night. High today 65, low 31. On Tuesday, cloudy, breezy, and colder with a high of 38 and a low of 22. On Wednesday, a high of 47 and a low in 29, mostly sunny. And on Thursday, warmer with more sunshine, a high of 61 and a low of 44. And tracking precipitation in the 24 hours ending 4 p.m. Saturday, there was zero precipitation. Our month to date, we've had 1.13 inches against a normal of 1.51 inches at this time of the month. Our year to date has been 3.46 inches against a normal of 3.99 inches. Last year on this date, we had had 4.95 inches for the year. Sunrise today was at 7:09 a.m., sunset tonight at 7:33 p.m., moonrise today 8:11 p.m., with moon set today at 7:22 a.m. Turning now to the front page of the Des Moines Register, here are the headlines. Osceola leaders suspect politics in a water crisis. Outlying precincts boosted Simonson. That would have been in the recent city council election. And the third story on the front page, the headline reads, Reynolds to discuss the Tyson closure with Perry leaders. Now, here with the first story is Nicole.
And we'll start in Osceola, where leaders there suspect politics in the water crisis. There's a large image of a man, the city manager, Ty Wheeler, standing in front of an early 20th century farmstead that an official from Iowa's State Historic Preservation Office says should be considered for placement on the National Register of Historic Places. It possibly endangers plans for a much-needed reservoir in that spot, but local officials disagree. So in that image, you just see a house behind this person, along with some branches, kind of like a wooded area. But the story is about plans to build South Iowa Reservoir facing series of obstacles. This is from Lee Rout of the Des Moines Register. To understand the latest obstacle blocking a more than two-decade effort to bring more water to supply to a part of the state that really needs it, drive about 6 miles northwest of the South Iowa town and have a look. Perched in the tall grass on the side of a gravel road with a pile of junk, dead trees, and discarded tires are three structures. A weather-worn, early 20th century farmhouse with holes in its floor, ceiling, and roof, an abandoned shed, and an equally aged and battered red wooden chicken coop. Area leaders learned at the end of February that the historic nature of this old farmstead, a common sense of rural decay in the Midwest, could be the next obstacle between them and roughly $60 million in federal funding that's needed to start work on a new reservoir in the Southwest Creek watershed. The huge project, local officials say, could eventually serve as many as 30,000 people in the drought-ridden South Central Iowa and Northern Missouri. But the list of problems that have confronted this effort, most tying back to Iowa state officials, has run so long that some local leaders don't think it's a coincidence. Osceola City Manager Ty Wheeler said, "The need for water here is well documented, and now the crisis we feared is being realized. But these are the ridiculous things that we're having to go through." The one-time home of Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, a former Clark County treasurer, Osceola has known for more than 20 years that the region will need a water source. But its declining water supply amid the state's fourth year of drought, it is the longest stretch in two decades, has now brought on new urgency. Nearly all of Clark County, where Osceola is the county seat, is experiencing severe or extreme drought. It is so bad that residents have been put on notice to use bottled water instead of tap. And if the area's dwindling primary source of residential and industrial water, 377-acre Westlake, recedes a couple of more feet, major regional employers like Hormel Foods, livestock producers, and area residents will not have enough water to go on without measures. As Osceola leaders waited for the money, planning and permission needed to start work on a new reservoir, they asked state regulators in October to allow it to use treated wastewater to charge Westlake. The request of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources to pursue the $16.5 million project was the first in the state seeking to recycle wastewater to supply drinking water. The plan has been taken much back and forth between local authorities and the DNR, but it's looking like it's moving forward, and it is expected to produce a product as clean as distilled water, according to Wheeler. But to solve the longer-term issue, the Clark County Reservoir Commission believes that construction of the new reservoir is imperative. After the devastating loss of Federal Natural Resources Conservation Service funding for that project because of budget cuts back in 2011, Osceola and a group of other local governments, agencies, and regional water works did move forward without a federal partner. In the ensuing years, the commission has faced significant political challenges as it attempted to acquire the land that's needed in and around the site of this envisioned 800-acre reservoir. It sought to use eminent domain, but a state appropriations bill that's passed in 2015, put forward by the legislature's Republican majority, added prohibitions on eminent domain for counties exactly the size of Clark. The commission eventually found another way to proceed, and members thought it's the most difficult challenges were behind it. This is according to Wheeler. In 2020, after the commission prepared the site and tore down some homes in anticipation for this project, the U.S. Natural Resources Conservation Service did agree once more to help finance this project with about $60 million. But to move forward, the commission needs the Iowa State Historical Preservation's office blessing to eventually receive the federal money. That state office is now under the Iowa Economic Development Authority and its leader, Debbie Durham, since last year's state government reorganization. This person and the office administers those federal programs. But a year ago this month, local leaders say that archaeologists at the State Historic Preservation Office raised new problems with federal officials. One sent an email to officials at the NRCS, that is the U.S. Department of the Agriculture and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, that, among other things, voiced concerns about anticipatory activities that's taken by the commission as it had prepared for this area for this project. The email from Daniel Higginbottom urged NRCS and the Corps of Engineers to investigate the commission's actions to determine if any resulted in adverse effects to historic properties that may be subject to the National Historic Preservation Act. The email also voiced concerns about any other plans to destroy standing structures and about earth moving that could happen at that site. In the years prior, when the commission has relocated some homes and demolished others near the reservoir site, the NRCS hasn't been involved and the Preservation Act wasn't in play. Higginbottom suggested that the commission's actions could have violated federal law, thereby compromising and otherwise complicating a federal agency's ability to successfully navigate through and complete federal review and compliance processes. He also mentioned that a Native American mound just outside the reservoir area and advised that it should be further investigated with research and sampling. A subsequent email in January from the state archaeologist Brandon Scott suggested that the NRCS, the federal agency most likely to lead this project, had not considered all effects and potential historic properties. Some properties, the Historic Preservation Office said, were historic farms or homes that were removed from 2019 to 2021, but most were outside the area, potentially impacted by this new reservoir. The move set in motion new hurdles for local officials because the state archaeologist was saying a deeper review of the project was necessary. And then in this March, Sarah Andre, the archaeological historian with the same state office, sent another email to federal authorities. Andre took issue with the new consultant's survey of the area that found the old farmstead was not eligible to be placed on the National Register of Historic Places. To be eligible for this register, sites have to meet certain criteria and possess integrity, conveying significance through physical features and context. Andre thought the site did. She argued while the farmstead may be in poor condition, the integrity of the resources is good. The farmstead does represent an early mid-20th century farm in a time when farms were evolving and changing, representing shifts in methods, equipment, etc. And as such, it does appear that the Hofbauer farmstead at 1913 Orange Street in Osceola is eligible. So then regional officials are once again stalled, waiting to see how the NRCS will react. If the agency determines that there could be an adverse effect, then it could consult further on appropriate measures needed to avoid, minimize, or mitigate that effect. Wheeler said the correspondence from the state office bothered him because it seemed like an overreach for state agencies that is essentially a middleman between local authorities and the federal government. At the point the first email by an archaeologist was sent, he said, the NRCS hasn't even done any of its own fieldwork. The email from Andre riled up the Osceola City Council because it felt like the structures referenced were not salvageable or historically significant. And the Historic Preservation Office actions triggered new investigations that could push that project's groundbreaking back even further to 2025 or 2026. Wheeler says there's this growing sense that the bigger things are at work that are preventing this project from moving forward. The Iowa Economic Development Authority, the Historic Preservation Office's parent agency, didn't respond to a request for comment. Tom Balls, an Osceola City Council member, said that until last week, there was no urgency from the governor's office or the state to help this area with the project, and now it is the biggest issue in the region, or it is the biggest issue in the region right now. But after some state officials went to a conference recently in Denver that helped them better understand temporary plans to use retreated wastewater and also watchdogs' inquiries with the IEDA and the Historic Preservation Office, things seem to be turning a corner. The city manager, council members, water board officials, and others have been invited to meet with representatives of the governor's office on Tuesday, according to Balls. They're expected to talk about short-term and long-term support for this project. At the Denver conference, also attended by some state legislators, he said, there were officials from 22 other states who want to use treated wastewater to help with water shortages. He says things are moving. People are finally returning our calls. I'm hoping that it's partly because of questions that they were fielding from you. The local commission wants to do everything properly and legally, he says, but I think the state is finally seeing that our need is one of the urgency.
Outlying precincts boosted Simonson. Des Moines has a new city council member after Mike Simonson defeated Justin Lewis and several other candidates in Tuesday's special election to win the right to serve the remainder of Mayor Connie Boson's term. The special election lacked the drama of other recent citywide races, such as last November's mayoral race, when less than 3 percentage points separated the top two candidates. Simonson won the seat with relative ease, earning about 58% of the primary vote count. I'm sorry, that would be the preliminary vote count, according to unofficial results from the Polk County Auditor. Lewis came in second with about 33% of the vote. None of the three remaining candidates, Dr. Claudia Andy, Benjamin Clark, and Rosemary Smith, nor Robert Pate, who had dropped out of the race before the election day but remained on the ballot, none of them earned more than 3% of the votes. Precinct-by-precinct vote counts from the auditor's office show voting patterns in Des Moines for the at-large election loosely mimic those of the November mayoral race, where Boson claimed victory over Councilmember Josh Mandelbaum. Here are some takeaways from the precinct-level data. first, which parts of Des Moines voted for Simonson and which for Lewis? Well, Simonson's strongest pockets of support came from the outer portions of Des Moines, the precinct-level data shows. Those were precincts such as Precincts 1 and 24 in the northeast corner of the city near Altoona, where 58 of 74 voters filled in Simonson's bubble. Precincts in the southwest corner of the city, south of Grand and west of Fleur Drive, collectively voted for Simonson at a rate of about 70% compared to 23% for Lewis. Lewis, meanwhile, had the most success north of downtown. He won 12 precincts north of Interstate 235 and just 3 south of it. One of those precincts includes the East Village, where Lewis won nearly 30 percentage points, albeit across the small population of voters. He won by nearly 30 percentage points, and that was a small population of voters. Lewis did not win any other precinct by more than 25 percentage points, and that's where Simonson pulled ahead. He kept it close in the precincts Lewis won and racked up large shares of the votes in many other precincts. Broken down by ward, Lewis garnered the strongest support in the southern edges of Ward 1, which is the northwest part of the city, and Ward 2, the northeast portions of the city. Meanwhile, Simonson dominated in the other parts of Wards 1 and 2, and the vast majority of Ward 3, which is central and southwest, and Ward 4, which is the southeastern part of Des Moines. If the precinct-level map from Tuesday's special election looks familiar, it may be because the election for Des Moines mayor last November showed a similar-looking spread of votes. Boson's politics are not a one-on-one analog for Simonson, nor is Lewis a perfect match to Mandelbaum, but the two pairs drew from similar areas of support. In the mayoral election, Boson defeated Mandelbaum with victories in outer precincts. Like Lewis, Mandelbaum won precincts representing the downtown area and areas north of I-235. But Boson stayed close enough in those areas for her to win in the south and east of the city to carry her victory. But Boson's win was much closer than Simonson's, decided by fewer than 1,000 votes. That's because Simonson's margins over Lewis were better across the city, and particularly in the downtown area. In one location, Precinct 44 in the heart of downtown, bounded by the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers, Grand Avenue to the north, and 9th Street to the west. Mandelbaum won this precinct by more than 20 percentage points in November, but Simonson earned 56% of the vote there Tuesday, building a margin of more than 16 percentage points. Turnout in November's general election resulted in much higher vote totals than Tuesday's one-off special election. Voters cast more than 30,000 ballots in the mayoral race. The total cast in the special election was slightly less than a quarter of that. The distribution of votes across Des Moines, however, was remarkably similar between the two elections, and many of the areas that cast the most votes were also the areas where Simonson won big, particularly the southeast portions of the city. The high turnout there, coupled with Simonson's high margins of victory in that area, resulted in an insurmountable lead and a relatively easy victory for Des Moines' newest city council member.
And the last headline in the front page of the Des Moines Register is Reynolds to discuss Tyson closure with Perry leaders. The mayor to seek extended unemployment benefits. This is from Donnell Eller and Allison Ullman of the Des Moines Register. Governor Kim Reynolds will be meeting with Perry officials in the coming days to talk about the Dallas County City's needs as Tyson Foods, its largest employer, prepares to lay off nearly 1,300 workers. Perry Mayor Dirk Cavanaugh says that his agenda for this meeting, which he said will happen on Thursday, includes asking Reynolds to extend state unemployment compensation for these workers. Effective in July of last year, or 2022 rather, she and Republican legislators cut the period that Iowa workers can collect unemployment benefits to 16 weeks from 26. Iowa's maximum of 16 weeks is among the shortest in the country. Reynolds, through spokesperson Colin Crompton, on Friday said that she had directed Iowa Workforce Development Director Beth Townsend and Economic Development Authority Director Debbie Durham to reach out to Tyson officials and Perry leaders after the giant meatpacker said on March 11th it would close its Perry pork processing plant by late June. Crompton said in a statement, conversations began immediately, and meetings were held within days. He said of that discussion with the Perry leaders will focus on their priorities for the community as they prepare for the closure. Tyson's plant exit, closing a plant that has been a cornerstone of the city's economy since 1961, is the second big blow this year to Perry. The town of about 8,000 residents already is struggling with the January school shooting that left three dead, including the high school principal, and also injured six others. Kavanaugh said on Friday that he has a slate of concerns that he wants to talk about with the governor, including attracting a new employer to the city, ways to retain the workforce, and how the school district could be impacted by the shutdown. He said he wants to talk about financial support for the Perry School District, which faces a budget hit if as many as 290 children of plant workers leave the community. He also wants to talk about a possible program to help stabilize the city's housing market. Now, in the wake of Tyson's announcement, Democrats who opposed reducing the compensation period have now criticized Reynolds for signing it into law. She and other Republicans have said the move was needed to boost the workforce available to the state's employers. Kavanaugh said that retaining workers and helping them retain if needed will be key to attracting a new employer to Perry. He says, "We don't want to lose all of the employees because that would be one of the reasons why they, a new company, would come here." Arkansas-based Tyson's closure of the plant will impact 1,276 workers, according to the company's notice to the Iowa Workforce Development. The decision was not easy, the company said in a statement at the time, but then added that it was necessary to optimize the efficiency of our operations. The decision came as the pork industry struggles with its worst financial downturn in 25 years. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union is negotiating severance pay for the soon-to-be-laid-off Perry workers, and Perry officials have said that they hope the company will likewise provide some aid to the city. Tyson has said that it hopes to find jobs for Perry workers at other plants, but it hasn't answered questions about how many positions may be available. It said that it employs 9,000 people at the Iowa processing plants in Waterloo, Storm Lake, and Columbus Junction. Iowa Workforce Development said its rapid response team and new mobile workforce center, that's a bus where workers can meet with job counselors, will be at the Tyson plant from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. today and tomorrow to answer initial questions and prepare those workers for the next steps, which includes critical services that will guide them through the layoff process and into re-employment. The agency said it is planning to provide service over several weeks to help those workers find new jobs. It also said that it plans to open an office at the Tyson plant and provide assistance in multiple languages, reflecting the needs of the heavily immigrant Perry workforce. The community and state agencies are organizing a job fair that is slated for April 3rd. Townsend said in a statement, "While this is just the initial phase of services for this June layoff, we are committed to supporting every impacted worker through the process to ultimately help them find a new career in the state." Allison Ullman is the editor of the Perry Chief. You can reach her at the Perry Chief email. And then Donnell Eller covers agriculture over at the Register. Just a little bit of a background about the authors who wrote this piece.
And that concludes the front page stories for the Register. We'll turn now to the Metro and Iowa section. And before our first story, I want to share with you a photo spread from the front page of the Metro and Iowa section. As you're no doubt aware, we are in the midst of Ramadan, the Islamic holy month. And this picture, these pictures are from Waqi, and it shows there are two pictures of people praying prior to breaking their daily fast at an iftar, which is the evening meal after sunset, with which they break fast each day. And the larger picture shows a lot of people at a buffet line that's laid out in Waukee High School. Looks as if they are getting to ready to enjoy what appears to be a delicious meal breaking that fast. And we wish a Ramadan Mubarak to all of our Islamic listeners. First story here, mother wants better police training. The mother of the man who was killed by a Fort Dodge Police Department officer on March 16 said her son was having a schizophrenic episode when he was shot and that she hopes authorities will be trained in dealing with mental health issues. The man shot and killed by police Saturday morning was 24-year-old Tyler C. Stansberry of Fort Dodge. He was diagnosed with autism at an early age and then schizophrenia at 19, said Christine Stansberry, his mother. He was loving, funny, smart kid who really was kind and laughed a lot, Stansbury said. He enjoyed playing video games and hanging out with his friends. He was somebody who protected his younger brother. Tyler Stansbury had struggled with mental health episodes after his schizophrenia diagnosis, she said. He was living with his brother and mother at their house in Fort Dodge when the shooting happened, Christine Stansbury said. She had left the house for some errands when she received a phone call from her other son saying that Tyler was having an episode. By the time I got there, the cops and my younger son were standing outside my house, she said. The police would not let us inside the house. Fort Dodge authorities said that Tyler Stansbury had an active warrant out for violation of probation stemming from a domestic abuse case. The charges stemmed from a mental health episode, and the family asked to not press charges, according to the mother. The family did not know about the warrant, she said. Authorities said officers entered the home and Tyler Stansbury, armed with two knives, ran at them. That is when an officer on the scene discharged his firearm, resulting in the death of the individual. That's a quote from the police report. Fort Dodge Police on Friday released the names of the four officers involved in the shooting. Fort Dodge Police on Friday released the names of the four officers involved in the shooting as Matthew English, Andrew Lane, Nicholas Ruggles, and Matthew Webb, but it did not specify which one fired the fatal shot. They didn't even try talking to him. It must have been only 17 minutes between the time when they went in and the shots were fired, said Christine Stansbury. The police officers involved in the shooting were placed on critical incident leave while the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation investigates the incident, according to a news release. The situation has been mentally taxing on the family as they mourn Tyler's death, according to the mother. I'm just in the process of grieving and trying to lay my son to rest, she said. Christine Stansbury hopes the Fort Dodge Police Department focuses its efforts on dealing with mental health issues in the future to avoid any unnecessary deaths. The Fort Dodge Police Department did not respond to multiple requests for comment.
Next, Grinnell student case still unsolved. Tammy Jo Zwicky killed over 30 years ago. So who is Tammy Jo Zwicky? She was the victim in a murder abduction mystery with Iowa ties that has gone unsolved for more than 30 years, despite an investigator's expression of strong suspicions about a now-dead trucker. A native of New Jersey who grew up in South Carolina, Zwicky, who was 21, vanished in central Illinois on August 23, 1992, after her car broke down on I-80 as she was driving to Grinnell College to begin her senior year. The 21-year-old's disappearance after dropping her brother off at Northwestern University in Evanston made international news. Her petite body was found 9 days later, about 500 miles away in a ditch off a stretch of Interstate 44 between Springfield and Joplin in Missouri. She had been stabbed 8 times, raped, and rolled up in a red blanket, sealed on both ends with duct tape. The case, featured on CNN, The Oprah Winfrey Show, and America's Most Wanted, triggered thousands of leads, including suspicion that convicted murderer and suspected highway serial killer Bruce Mendenhall could have been to blame. But Illinois State Police investigator Marty McCarthy, who retired in 2001, said several times that there was compelling circumstantial evidence that Looney Beerbrot, an ex-con trucker with ties to both Illinois and Missouri, should be the prime suspect. Beerbrot died in 2002, and Zwicky's family still has no answers. McCarthy told the Des Moines Register in 2014 that the Illinois State Police and FBI appeared to give up on Beerbrot as a suspect after the 20th anniversary of her death in 2012. McCarthy says that Hiram Grew, Illinois State Police Director from 2011 until 2015, showed an interest in this case and contacted him. But after Beerbrot's ex-wife refused to talk to investigators, who a nurse at a health clinic reported had showed off a musical watch similar to the one that belonged to Zwicky and then went missing after her abduction, the trail appeared to have run out. According to McCarthy, Beerbrot lived in Missouri, close to the stretch of the highway where Zwicky's body was discovered. He drove a Kenworth truck, according to news reports, and the red blanket in which Zwicky's body was found had a Kenworth logo. Birabrad is a LaSalle County native, confirmed to investigators that he had been near the spot on I-80 where she was last seen on the day of the abduction. His brothers and mothers lived in Peru, Illinois area, and he had been trying to get a job there. Zewicki's case remains listed on both the Illinois State Police and FBI's websites. Anyone with information is asked to call the Illinois State Police. That number is 815-726-6377 or the FBI Chicago's office at 312-421-6700. You can also send a message via tips.fbi.gov.
Cactus Jack Berenger is ready to ride off into the sunset. Cactus Jack Berenger of Ames is a shark expert, but he is retiring after a final speaking event on Tuesday. Now 80 years old, the inventor was featured on Season 1, Episode 5 of ABC's Shark Tank and has been a mentor and entrepreneurial role model for Iowa State students for many years. Berenger will appear with Iowa State grad, investor, and entrepreneur Brandon Adams, one of the students he mentored. With a larger-than-life personality and a colorful cowboy wardrobe to match, Berenger says he's ready to ride off into the sunset after out-sharking the sharks, which will be from 4 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday at 1148 Gurdon Business Building. Back in the old days, we had the Lone Ranger, Hopalong Cassidy, Roy Rogers, all famous cowboys, and Clint Eastwood at the end of The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, Berenger said. I always noticed at the end of the movies, they'd say, my job here is done. I'm going to ride off into the sunset, and that's what I'm going to do, he said. Emmy Berenger, Cactus Jack's high school sweetheart and wife of nearly 61 years, does not think he will really retire. Berenger said he will continue to work on his memoirs, which includes some of what he calls unbelievable stories. Some of those stories Berenger shares at Tuesday's event. At the end of his speech, he will be publicly sharing a lifelong secret that he has told few people before. Berenger has 12 patents and has brought more than 50 products to market. His Shark Tank appearance involved his invention Body Jack, a contraption that assisted with push-ups. Berenger's daughter, Kelly Mason, a fitness expert, joined him on the show to help demonstrate it. Cactus Jack entered the Shark Tank dressed in one of his iconic cowboy outfits, custom designed by a Hollywood tailor and costing up to $3,000. Kevin, so-called Mr. Wonderful, O'Leary, one of the sharks, said, well, Tex, are you from Texas? No, I'm from Iowa. Where are you from? Berenger responded. Canada, O'Leary said. I said, oh, I'm glad you told me. I'll talk a little slower for you. All the other sharks laughed, and then Kevin just glared at me, Berenger said. Cactus Jack did not win over Mr. Wonderful, but he did gain the confidence of Barbara Corcoran, who offered half of the investment if another shark would join her deal. She was joined by Kevin Harrington. They each invested $90,000 for 25% of Barrington's push-up machine business for a total deal of $180,000 for 50%. I weighed 270 pounds at the time, said Barbara, and I'd have to lose 30 pounds to get the deal. No, let me start that. This is a quote here, and I quoted it incorrectly. This is Berenger speaking. I weighed 270 pounds at the time, and Barbara said I'd have to lose 30 pounds to get the deal. I figured it was worth $180,000 to lose the weight, so I took the deal, Berenger said. Cactus Jack lost the weight and traveled to New York to accept the funds during a celebration with the sharks. The group was invited to ring the opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange on the same day. Berenger said while he was with the group on the stage by the bell, another shark, Damon John, pointed out the window and said, Cactus Jack, see that corner? That's where I got my start. Damon had worked on the street corner in Manhattan shining shoes, Berenger said. He came from a poor family and built his business up from nothing, he added. Cactus Jack's television success was not limited to Shark Tank. One day, a friend from church called him and said QVC was having a trade show in Des Moines where they were looking for products for TV. Berenger showed up to apply to be a vendor on the popular Shop From Home network. He had 5 minutes to make an impression on the show's producers. The product Berenger wanted to sell was called One Shot, an all-purpose cleaner that came in the shape of bullets and could be dissolved in water. It was the idea inspired by a plop, plop, fizz, fizz Alka-Seltzer commercial. More than 300 companies from all over Iowa showed up for the trade show ready to make their pitches. As usual, he showed up in full Cactus Jack regalia. His competitors all looked alike in their cookie-cutter suits, he said. Everyone else had fancy booths, but Berenger just had a table with a box of his product in the middle of it. Berenger gave a demonstration of One Shot, dropping the bullets of cleaner into a quart spray bottle and removing stains with it. A few days later, they announced that there were 20 finalists and Cactus Jack was one of them. QVC brought their mobile studios from Pennsylvania to Dyersville, Iowa, a couple of months later. Each vendor had 10 minutes to make their pitch on live TV. I got a great big cowboy duster on and a big hat, and I walked out with spray bottles in holsters and take them out and twirl them, Berenger said. 8 minutes into the 10-minute segment, the host said Cactus Jack would have to stop. They had sold out of One Shot. It was the first sale Berenger had of his new invention, and it was for $100,000. His second appearance on QVC gave him 2 shows of 10 minutes each. He sold out then, too, with a QVC order of $250,000. Over the next 5 years, I sold $10 million worth of those bullets, all because I saw a little commercial on TV, Berenger said. This experience is one of the personal stories Berenger will share Tuesday during his speech, which he has titled, How to Get and Market $1 Million Ideas. Adams would not have met Berenger if he had not been failing his speech class at Iowa State University. My journey at Iowa State was a little crazy because I wasn't very good book smart, Adams said. After asking for extra credit in his speech class, he was sent to one of Cactus Jack's lectures. I sat in the front row and it was very inspiring for me as an entrepreneur, Adams said. He led me to the book Think and Grow Rich. At the time, I was 20 and still trying to figure things out. The book changed how I thought, he said. Berenger, too, points to the book written by Napoleon Hill as seismic in how he looks at life. Cactus Jack is such a proponent of Think and Grow Rich, the most recent edition's editor requested him to write a blurb for the back of the book. It reads as follows, Think and Grow Rich, buy it. You have a book. Read it. You have the blueprint. Do it. You have the world. Cactus Jack Berenger, entrepreneur, inventor, and salesman extraordinaire. That's the end of the quote from the back of the book. Eventually, Berenger became a mentor to Adams, and they would spend time in Cactus Jack's home office deep in discussion. My first invention back in the day was called the Arctic Stick, Adams said. I ended up hiring Cactus Jack, and he helped me pursue the endeavor from start up to product in the market. That was the beginning of our relationship, he said. That bond that began about 15 years ago remains strong today. Today, Adams is like a shark himself. He's just not on the TV show. He's an Emmy Award-winning producer, TV host, and startup investor. I invest in deals. I advise deals. We market products and services. We raise money for companies, he said. We also have an investment fund that we use to deploy capital into other companies. In a fun circle of events, Adams explained that through his relationship with Cactus Jack, he became acquainted with Kevin Harrington. We all got connected and eventually partnered with Kevin. So Kevin and I have about 35 or 40 investments together. We're partners, and I directly correlate that to the initial contact at Iowa State University, Adams said. And if you want to attend Out Sharking the Sharks, here's how you can do it. The event is free to the public. Organizers request that people register online in advance at www.isupjcenter.org. The program begins at 4 p.m. Tuesday at 1148 Gurdon Business Building on Iowa State's campus. A reception will follow the presentation. The program is a Start Something event and is co-hosted by Sigma Nu Tau Entrepreneurship Honor Society, Entrepreneur Club, and Entrepreneurship Product Development Club. Additional financial support is provided by the Riemann Entrepreneurial Speaker Series program at the Papa John Center for Entrepreneurship.
mental health facility for suicidal ideation, depression, and anxiety, she is scared and uncertain. Every few days, she answers a series of questions targeting anxiety and depression. The program then calculates her risks and then, comparing her answers over time, predicts the best plan to get her on a healthy path. Her clinicians then analyze the data, offer treatments, and then the cycle repeats. The young woman continues to log her answers, her mood dramatically lightening over time. That's been the general response of patients at Rogers Behavioral Health in Wisconsin since one of its residential treatment facilities launched an artificial intelligence program a year ago to predict the risk of suicide and how a patient responds to treatment. AI has terrible PR issues, though, and for some good reason, said Joe Osterweil, an associate professor of psychology with an affiliate appointment in computer science over at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But while Osterweil isn't familiar with Rogers' AI technology, he's not too concerned about its role in mental health. Osterweil says that getting people to use mental health support more is such a big issue that if this makes a small dent in that issue, it is a huge breakthrough and a major success. Rogers has been working on its in-house AI program over the last decade. It is ahead of the curve, at least in Wisconsin, where several other mental health providers said they're not using AI yet. Debbie Patz, vice president of Bellin Psychiatric Center, says that medical experience and training would still need to be coupled with AI for patient care, and there are some things a trained expert would still need to do in person. For example, a patient in crisis may report feeling fine, but then exhibit signs such as profuse sweating, pacing, or trouble focusing. AI could, of course, play a role, she said. At Rogers, AI serves to augment clinical human work, according to Chief Strategy Officer Dr. Brian Kay. Kay says it's not a tool that will replace clinicians or treatment, but it may be helpful in identifying patterns that a human may not easily see. Rogers' AI program monitors the progress of long-term residential patients. They're an ideal population on which to pilot this technology because of the length of stay and treatment intensity, Kay said. As patients engage with the AI software throughout their time at a long-term residential facility, clinicians can learn which treatments reduce behavioral symptoms, Kay said. As the AI suggests treatment strategies, human clinicians talk through those issues with the patient that's guided by data. It's a way to validate clinicians' hypotheses of what's working and what's not, and which each new data set the AI learns. Before it launched, the AI program trained off the data set of close to 30,000 patients. Then in 2023, it added 2,500 patients to its algorithm. Kay explained that Rogers gave its homegrown AI program aggregated data from the clinic's various services, and the program was able to pick up key patterns. Who got better through treatment and why? Who didn't get better through treatment and why? Kay says if we can identify if someone falls into one of those patterns, we can change their treatment plan early on in collaboration with the patient. It gives them the best chances to respond to treatment during the course of their stay. You can think of Rogers' AI software like a GPS determining the best route out of traffic. It doesn't take them to the place of the driver, but by analyzing the different routes and real-time traffic patterns, it offers a path that can get you home faster. The use of AI, at least in Rogers' context, is part of an existing science-driven approach to mental health called measured-based care. According to the American Psychological Association, measurement-based care tracks behavioral health screening tools and other routine assessments to inform treatment decisions and engage patients on their journey to healing. Having AI handle the work of mental health screening and data analysis frees up time for clinicians to work immediately and accurately with patients. AI may especially be useful for predicting suicidality in patients, Kay said. Sleep disturbances in particular offer insights for clinicians. Rogers uses the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale, considered the gold standard by behavioral health professionals, to interview patients on their risk levels. But measurement-based care remains an underutilized resource in behavioral health, Kay said. Less than 20% of behavioral health practitioners use it, even though study after study demonstrates that it does improve outcomes. In the absence of measurement-based care, research shows that clinicians do struggle to identify when patients aren't responding to treatment, and more concerning, fail to note when a patient's mental health is deteriorating. The arrival of Roger's AI software comes at an inflection point. AI is everywhere, and it's not going away. With its ubiquity, however, comes caution as Americans grow increasingly leery of this technology. Consider recent data from Pew Research Center from 2021 to 2023. The percentage of people who surveyed who said that they're more concerned than excited about AI went up from 37% to 52%. Of specific discomfort was the healthcare industry's increasing reliance on this AI technology. 6 in 10 of U.S. adults stating that they're uncomfortable with the idea. Americans were split on whether AI could improve, worsen, or make no difference in their health outcomes, with slightly more stating that AI would be better for their health. One widely expressed concern is about how AI will interfere with the patient-provider relationship. Kay says, part of it, I think, is the mystery of AI. AI is a black box, right? A lot of providers, they look at it like, how am I supposed to use something I don't actively understand? However, there may have been a lot to worry about when it comes to AI. Osterweil says that it's likely not going to come from behavioral healthcare. The technique is also taking center stage as clinicians continue to find themselves overbooked and short-staffed. AI in therapy may be suspicious for some, but is it worse than waiting 6 months to a year to see a human clinician? Osterweil, who teaches machine learning, said no. On the contrary, leveraging AI to broaden the public's access to therapy can only be a benefit, especially at a time when wait times to see a counselor are, in Osterweil's words, optimal. Osterweil and Kay named several other areas where AI is proving useful. AI can be a especially helpful tool when diagnosing neurodiverse patients, such as those who have autism, whose conditions are often misdiagnosed. Some of that is a result of masking, when an autistic person suppresses behavior in order to be seen as neurotypical. But the urge to camouflage may not necessarily be there if a person is expressing their feelings to a machine. In other words, the fear of being judged all but disappears. Indeed, the ability to speak to a machine can help any person who's wary of therapy. Shame and stigma can also interfere with how someone presents their mental health to a physician. Osterweil says expressing some of those struggles to a machine instead of a human can allow for people to share more information than they otherwise might. It is less taboo to tell a computer you're in a dark place, which might explain why so many people express more details about their mental states on social media. Finally, AI can relieve the staffing burdens in residential settings. Relieving some burdens is important for mental health providers who have to do more with less, Kay said. Measurement-based care has a host of benefits, but having patients fill out forms a few times a week can be exhausting for the clinician who is already overbooked. Rather than a clinician milling through stacks of patient forms, AI can sort and flag the critical data that a clinician needs. A note here, if you or somebody you know is dealing with suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicidal Prevention Lifeline at 988 or text the word HOPELINE to the National Crisis Text Line at 741-741.
The United Methodist Church is set for a historic meeting in North Carolina. A gathering of the United Methodist Church's top legislative body next month will be historic for the nation's largest mainline Protestant denomination, but not in the way many originally anticipated. The UMC General Conference, which meets every 4 years, is set to convene April 23 in Charlotte, North Carolina, to decide which legislation will shape the long-term future of the denomination. The General Conference, originally scheduled for 2020 and postponed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, follows a five-year-long exodus of mainly conservative churches. Between 2019 and 2023, the United Methodist Church lost about a quarter of its total churches. With all of the changes that have happened in our midst, we find ourselves in a seminal moment in the life of this denomination, said Bishop Thomas Bickerton, president of the UMC Council of Bishops, in a March 1 delegate orientation speech. It's a marker point, a shift, a pivot from what was to what can be, he said. More than 7,000 churches left the denomination or disaffiliated in the past 5 years following disputes over theology and church policy, including dealing with LGBTQ plus rights. Many disaffiliated churches joined a more conservative breakaway denomination, which is called the Global Methodist Church. During the two-week event, 862 General Conference delegates representing a dozen-plus countries will vote on removing anti-LGBTQ policies, potential major changes in the denomination's international structure, and a drastically reduced budget. Delegates, UMC agencies, and others have submitted 1,000-plus petitions ahead of time. During the first week of the General Conference, 15 different legislative committees will sort through those petitions and decide which ones to approve and/or consolidate to send to the full General Conference. The 862 delegates will then spend the second week debating and voting on those proposals. The second week of business is accessible to the public via live stream. Amid dozens of important decisions facing the UMC General Conference, three rise to the top. The first is LGBTQ plus rights. LGBTQ plus rights has consistently been the most contentious issue at the United Methodist Church's General Conferences in prior years, so much so that it set the stage for the splintering in the denomination. No discussion of social witness legislation would be complete without mentioning LGBTQ inclusion, said United Methodist News reporter Sam Hodges in a February 29 delegate orientation presentation. This time could be different due to the recent conservative exodus, potentially yielding success for progressive proposals to remove bans on ordination of LGBTQ plus people, prohibitions on UMC clergy or churches blessing same-sex unions, and financial penalties for United Methodist churches and other groups that, in the words of the current policy, promote the acceptance of homosexuality. Also, the same group is seeking changes in the UMC revised social principles, which currently states that homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. The second issue is regionalization. Referring to a series of legislative proposals, regionalization would fundamentally alter the relationship between the United Methodist Church in the United States and in other countries. Guided by the principle of decolonization, regionalization would give United Methodist regional authorities in other countries more autonomy. Progressives support regionalization because it would likely allow the American church to move in a more LGBTQ plus affirming direction, for example, while United Methodists in conservative regions can maintain stricter policies. But opponents of the proposal, most of whom are conservative and now part of the Global Methodist Church, want the UMC General Conference to expand and extend a policy allowing disaffiliation, which expired at the end of 2023. The regionalization proposal includes constitutional amendments, thus requiring ratification by not only the General Conference, but regional legislative bodies, explained United Methodist News reporter Heather Hahn in a March 1 delegation orientation presentation. As a result, if passed, the regionalization proposal would not take effect, likely, until 2026, Hahn said. And the third major issue, finances. Approving a budget will be one of the last decisions by the UMC General Conference and the beginning of drastic changes in the months to come. The Nashville-based UMC General Council on Finance and Administration, which is the denomination's administrative agency, is recommending a 43% decrease to the overall budget. Since the last time the UMC General Conference approved a budget at its 2016 regular session, disaffiliations and church closures torpedoed revenue projections and now require major cuts at every level of the UMC. We have to be smarter about how we use our money. We have to work together more to be effective, said Rick King, Chief Financial Officer for the UMC General Council on Finance and Administration, in a March 1 delegate orientation presentation. A more immediate effect following the General Conference will be when jurisdictional conferences meet later this year to decide on bishops' rosters. Most jurisdictional conferences will likely halt new bishop appointments and expand I'm sorry, most jurisdictional conferences will likely halt new bishop appointments and expand existing bishops' responsibilities. The United Methodist Church General Conference has grown accustomed to recent decades to emotionally charged debates during official business proceedings and in other moments such as disruptive protests. United Methodist leaders hope for different energy this year. The recent delegate orientation featured a panel on dialogue amid disagreement. We have a lot of legalism in our language and how we approach each other, said panelist S. Michael Pope, a lay delegate from California and a nonprofit leader. But if, as delegates, approached each other as siblings, as family, that had the opportunity to build our family in a different way, in a more loving and caring way. United Methodist News recently reported that prominent traditionalist advocacy groups still plan to attend the Charlotte Conference and lobby. Those groups have previously coalesced voting power with centrists to pass or preserve anti-LGBTQ plus politics.
And next, this local story before we get to birthdays is on the website on Des Moines Register. It's about a Des Moines man who's charged after pouring gasoline on his girlfriend and then setting the house on fire. This is from Jose Mendiola of the Des Moines Register. A Des Moines man was arrested and charged with attempted murder and arson after pouring gasoline on his girlfriend and then setting his house on fire on Sunday. This is according to a Des Moines Police Department news release that was sent out Monday morning. The Des Moines Police Department and the Des Moines Fire Department were dispatched to 3100th block of Amherst Street to investigate a residential fire around 2:55 in the afternoon. Witnesses told first responders that the suspect who started the fire was still in the house. This is according to Sergeant Paul Parizic of the Des Moines Police Department. Authorities then found Paul Lobaugh, 36 years old, inside that home, and he was detained without incident. Investigators did find evidence that Ball had a domestic dispute and then poured gasoline within the home and on his 39-year-old girlfriend. Parizic says prior to igniting the gasoline, Ball repeatedly told his girlfriend that because there were no children in the home, he was going to set them both on fire. Ball did ignite the fire and the girlfriend attempted to extinguish the fire before leaving the house. Nobody was seriously injured and the house did sustain some minor injuries. Ball has now been charged with attempted murder, arson, and domestic abuse with intent to inflict serious injury, according to Parizic. That person, Ball, is now being held at the Polk County Jail, and authorities continue to investigate this case. You want to go through a couple of 50 states, and then we can get started on birthdays? So I'll start with the highlight of Wisconsin, and then Twyla will take over. So the highlight today is in Wisconsin. There's an image of a diver investigating the remains of Sardinia. It's a shipwreck that's discovered last year in Wisconsin's Lake Michigan waters. So this is out of Milwaukee. Shipwreck hunters, divers, even a little girl out fishing found some of Lake Michigan's most historic secrets last year in record numbers. 13 new shipwrecks were found. According to the Wisconsin Historical Society, the previous record was just 4 shipwrecks in 2016, and usually there are only 2 or 3, according to Tamara Thompson, a maritime archaeologist. She says that no shipwrecks were discovered in Lake Superior waters last year, but one lucky discoverer was a 4-year-old girl who was fishing near Green Island in Lake Michigan with her father when she then spotted the remains of George L. Newman.
And in other 50-state roundups from the USA Today, this short piece from Des Moines, which was not covered in the Register, Des Moines missed most of its goals for affordable housing last year, according to a report the city is preparing to submit to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And from Illinois, from Rockford, officials say a Rockford man in prison for murdering 2 people in 2009 also is responsible for the 2002 stabbing death of a 71-year-old woman.